from Venice in Italy to St. Augustine here in Florida, what coastal cities are doing to address flooding and sea level rise. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this Monday morning, a conversation with Mike Cullum. He's the new Chief Resiliency Officer in the nation's oldest city, St. Augustine. You can join us. Give us a call. Let us know your thoughts about how to protect our coastal cities here in Florida from the effects of climate change. 549-2937. Then later, how you can namaste before game day with Yoga for Change. But first this morning, historic flooding in the Italian city of Venice has reminded everyone that the world's coastal cities are incredibly vulnerable to flooding and sea level rise. Venice, a city literally built on water, was hit with its worst flooding last week in half a century. Climate scientists say part of the increased frequency of flooding there is due to climate change. Now, here in our area, another coastal city that depends on tourism is getting proactive about planning for this future, looking at ways to become more resilient as the waters rise. Mike Cullum is St. Augustine's new Chief Resiliency Officer, and he's on the line from St. Johns County now with more about his new role for the nation's oldest city. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for being with us. And what are your questions for St. Augustine's new Chief Resiliency Officer? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And Mike, as we watch the flooding devastate Venice, an old city like St. Augustine that is heavily dependent on tourism like St. Augustine, I thought it was timely that we would be speaking to you this morning because, of course, St. Augustine also has unique history to protect from these effects of flooding and rising seas, right?
Yes, we do. We have approximately 2,500 historic structures in downtown St. Augustine, and we need to protect those structures and also the residents that live in places like Davis Shores from our flooding problems.
And so as the new Chief Resiliency Officer for St. Augustine, how does a job like this work? What's your portfolio? What are your biggest priorities?
So we have been working on resiliency for a number of years. The city started back in the 1990s, actually, with our first stormwater master plan. So we've been considering this for a while. We have had the advantage of working with the Department of Economic Development, DEO, as one of three cities back in 2016 to evaluate what our susceptibility was in the various different areas of the city. Following that, of course, we had Hurricane Matthew, and then we had the opportunity to come up with an adaptation plan in 2017 that would basically come up with a plan for fixing these flooding problems, and we've been implementing that ever since. What we are challenged with is the fact that the city has a very limited budget. Our total budget is $60 million, and that includes police, fire, rescue, all kinds of infrastructure maintenance, the physical plants, the water treatment plant, the wastewater treatment plant. So we have had to solicit and procure funding from either the state or the federal government to help us with our stormwater fixes that we're planning and designing right now.
It's 549-2937. What are your questions for Mike Cullum? He's the new Chief Resiliency Officer for St. Augustine. Okay, so you've been working on this in St. Augustine for a while. How does St. Augustine's vulnerability compare with what we're already seeing in South Florida, Mike? They've had a resiliency officer position down in Miami-Dade County for years, seeing regular sunny day flooding, people moving away from the coast down there already as the water comes in. How does that compare to the facts on the ground here in North Florida?
Well, the South Florida condition, there are four counties. They refer to themselves as the four-county compact. They have much worse problems than the city of St. Augustine, if you can believe that. Due to their geology, they have a limestone rock right at the surface that allows water to flow through the groundwater system, the ground system, the limestone system. And so we don't have that here. So we do have the ability to stop the sunny day flooding and to protect ourselves against the tropical events such as a Matthew or an Irma. But the big issue, Melissa, is the cost. For example, we have a project called Lake Maria Sanchez, which we are 60% into the design phase, which will protect 200 acres in the downtown St. Augustine area. A majority of those 25 historic structures are located within this 200-acre watershed. So that project is about a $16 million project, which with a $60 million total budget for everything that we do, we've had to procure funding from both the state and the federal government to construct that project.
Okay, so this is something that's only going to intensify, whether it's St. Augustine or Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about the fact that we don't have a resiliency position in Jacksonville? And, you know, we have just as much vulnerable coastline up here as you do down there. In fact, more.
Well, that's a good question. I would certainly encourage the city of Jacksonville to appoint a position. I know, and I've worked with the people at Public Works and with planning in Jacksonville. They are moving forward with programs. They have something called an adaptation action area, for example, mm-hmm. In Jacksonville, which the city of St. Augustine does not have. So they are moving forward. It's not that they're not addressing resiliency. We felt like we needed to have someone in St. Augustine to focus on resiliency as their full-time job. So like I mentioned earlier, we have been working on resiliency since the 90s and recently have made some excellent progress. The commission, our city commission, has dedicated funding towards tide check valves, for example, each year so that we can stop that sunny day flooding coming back through the pipes and into the roads in various places in the city. But from the city of Jacksonville's perspective, they are moving forward. The fact that they don't have a resilience officer is really kind of their choice. So certainly, having me in this position, I'll have a lot more opportunity to focus on the resiliency and on the sea level rise and on the flooding in St. Augustine as my primary mission.
And if you're just tuning in, what are your thoughts about how Florida is dealing with becoming more resilient? It's 549-2937 as we speak with St. Augustine's new Chief Resiliency Officer, Mike Cullum. You know, the state has its first Chief Resilience Officer. Her name's Julia Neshawat. We also have the first ever Science Officer. Governor Ron DeSantis appointed both of those new posts. How do you see the state working with cities like St. Augustine? We are a uniquely vulnerable state here in Florida. How will that all work, Mike?
We had a conference on Friday at the Guana-Talamano-Matanzas Research Reserve up in Ponte Vedra. And I was a part of that conference. I was the meeting chair. And I was very, very fortunate to have Dr. Neshawat serve as the keynote speaker for that meeting on Friday afternoon. Her presentation was outstanding. She shared with us that they are putting together a comprehensive statewide resilience approach that will be run through all the legislators and then be ready sometime this summer. So the city of St. Augustine, as part of my responsibility, is also to develop a defined plan that will address each of the different flooding items that we have. And there are two basic flooding areas. One is the nuisance flooding, and the other one is the tropical event, kind of catastrophic flooding. So the state is moving forward with Dr. Nishiwat's approach to have a comprehensive plan by the summer of 2020.
That's good. Now, of course, the catastrophic flooding that's driven by hurricanes and severe weather gets a lot of the attention, but it's the nuisance flooding that guys like you worry about just as much, if not more, right?
Yes, the nuisance flooding causes a lot of anxiety with our residents, a lot of stress when they see salt water on the streets, they can't get to their houses. That is a primary focus of what the city is doing. We were fortunate to acquire a piece of property this past winter that is in the lowest portion of the South Davis Shores area, which is our most impacted area in the city, although there are a number of other areas that are also impacted. And we're moving forward with remedying the worst problem. As we go through time, we're going to pick the low spot, the lowest of the low spots, fix that, and move forward, moving basically uphill, as it were, to fix problems one by one as we go. Once again, with funding being our limiting factor.
Okay, let's go to some calls now from Mike Cullum. He's the new resiliency officer for the city of St. Augustine. What are your questions? 549-2937. Give us a call. Megan is in St. Augustine. Hi, Megan. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Really well, thanks. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good, good. My question is, about the courts of San Marco in St. Augustine. We are just north of the Fullerwood neighborhood. And while, in fact, we abut the Fullerwood neighborhood, we're considered part of the historic Fullerwood neighborhood. However, while the Fullerwood neighborhood has been repiped and repaved and all sorts of flooding issues addressed there, the courts of San Marco, just to the north there, have been addressed.
Okay, Meg, you're cutting in and out. But Mike, can you hear what she's saying?
Yes, Port Theophilia and that neighborhood is an old neighborhood that was built basically in a historic wetland area. So they do have some significant issues. They're on our list of specific neighborhoods to address. And with our next version of our stormwater master plan, we'll come up with some detailed fixes. We have installed a tide check valve in the major pipe that discharges from this area, and that has helped with the sunny day flooding for the area. Because the area had a number of flooding scenarios in the past, the streets are kind of compromised. When you inundate your streets, it compromises the subgrade and causes some issues. So first we had to stop the water coming through that pipe, and then we'll have that neighborhood put on our paving plan for future paving. We do have a dedicated source of funding in addition to the tide check valves that the commission approved. We do have a dedicated funding plan where we're going neighborhood by neighborhood to address these substandard roads. We did Lincolnville this past year. As Megan mentioned, we've done Fullerwood adjacent to the Court Theo area, and we're moving into West Augustine this fiscal year. So we're going neighborhood by neighborhood, and we'll eventually get to all of the neighborhoods with the paving program.
Megan, I hope that answers your question. And Mike, you're already doing so many things proactively in the short term to improve quality of life for folks in St. Augustine. What about the long term? When you look down the road, 10 years, 20 years, and we look at the climate science projections on how much water is expected to rise if carbon emissions are not severely curtailed, what's the long-term picture like for a city like St. Augustine with these incredible, historically significant cultural treasures right there on the water?
Very good question. The long-term fix, and our city commission just approved at first reading the comprehensive plan for 2040. And that comprehensive plan included a required additional element called the perils of flood. The 2015 legislature, the state legislature, required this of all coastal communities. And so we prepared a perils of flood approach in two basic steps. One is to address the sunny day flooding, and the other is to address the larger storms, such as Hurricane Matthew. Hurricane Matthew reached elevation 7 feet when it hit in 2016. And so we have chosen that elevation as the first big step in terms of protecting us against these types of tropical events. Following that, we're going to need to have the federal government assistance. And so we have actually applied for and had authorized a plan. It's called the Back Bay Study through the United States U.S. Corps of Engineers, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And so that plan is awaiting funding. It's a $3 million three-year study that the Corps of Engineers will do, and the city manager and Commissioner Sykes Klein and Mayor Upchurch and I went to Washington to visit with our legislative team, Congressman Rutherford, Congressman Waltz, and the senators also this about 2 weeks ago to try to move forward with the funding for the study. So it's going to take some significant federal funding to come up with a construction funding for protection of the city long term. You mentioned Venice. We are not sinking. St. Augustine is not sinking. Venice is actually sinking. In addition to
yeah.
coming. Yes. So that's very, very unfortunate. But working with the federal government, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on this Back Bay study is included in our comprehensive plan recommendation. So we are lobbying in Washington, trying to get funding for this long-term evaluation to fix the long-term flooding issues associated with hurricanes in St. Augustine.
Let me ask you as well, Mike, some coastal cities around the country are looking in some areas at managed retreat for some homeowners as it becomes more and more apparent that their homes are vulnerable. Here in Jacksonville, for example, a community on the south bank of the St. John's River, South Shores, is undergoing a complete managed buyout by the city. At what point do you think managed retreat might become an option in your area and other parts of the state? And how is the state going to handle that expense?
It's an insurance issue, Melissa. It's repetitive loss. It doesn't make sense to try to protect a neighborhood that consistently gets flooded. And so the managed retreat is an option. The city of St. Augustine has not chosen that at this time. However, for the next update of our stormwater management plan, which we're projecting for fiscal year 2021, that option will be evaluated as a potential tool to deal with certain neighborhoods. It's a very emotional issue. People have families and children that grow up in these houses, and some of these houses are historic houses, but we haven't taken that step yet. I asked Dr. Nishiwat that question on Friday, and she is very interested also in evaluating that concept. But it does have a lot of downside. It's, you know, people's homes are very emotional items.
Exactly. That's why this issue is so difficult for folks, because you're looking at a very negative future for property and real estate values in Florida, right? Because so much of it is on the coast.
It is. And it's, if you can't get insurance for protecting, flood insurance for protecting your house, there's, you know, there's that issue also. So it's a very complex question, the retreat question. And as I said, we have here at St. Augustine have not made that commitment, but we will be evaluating that as an option in the future.
What are your final thoughts about this as we try to work on these issues positively and proactively here in Florida? Your biggest priority now and over the long term is the city's chief resilience officer.
Well, the biggest priority is this nuisance flooding. That's a very emotional item for the residents that live there. And I would just request that they have patience. We're moving as fast as we can to fix these different areas one by one, moving forward as our budget allows us. And it's not that we're not concerned about it or we're not sympathetic to these issues. It's just, once again, it's a funding issue. So I would just ask the residents to be patient, work with us, and we'll move forward.
Well, we thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. He's Mike Cullum, St. Augustine's brand new Chief Resiliency Officer, on the line from St. Augustine. Thanks, Mike. We'll check back in with you soon.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
A quick break, but up next, setting the city's longest table and how you can be part of this community-wide dinner. We'll be right back. Well, it's a free shared meal at one table, a heck of a table. It stretches hundreds of feet long. Now, this Wednesday night, the Jacks Chamber is hosting its fourth annual Longest Table Community Dinner in downtown Jacksonville, and you can be part of it. This is free. Shamika Wright is the Chamber's Community Outreach Director. She founded this event along with the Chamber back in 2016. Hey, Shamika, good morning.
Good morning.
So this is a free shared meal at one table, and it is the longest table anyone has ever seen in their life, right?
It is. Yes, so in 2016, I was sitting with our CEO, Daniel Davis, and he challenged me to come up with a way in order to bring the community together. Mm-hmm. And so I began to think about it and said, okay, what can I do that's different? What can I do that would also connect diverse groups, build relationships across economic development, racial, religious, and ethnic backgrounds? And what better way than to have dinner together at one table?
That's right. So you came up with the idea of a meal, and how did you decide it should be the longest table?
Actually, while I was in college, college freshman and I that we were part of SGA, and he came up with the longest breakfast table. Mm. And that was an event to actually provide breakfast to homeless people in Tallahassee. And so then that just became like something that people began to do. So once they heard about the longest breakfast table, you had the longest table in Tallahassee, you've had the longest table in other areas. What makes ours different is that ours is free. And
always nice.
Yes, always nice. And it's one continuous table. Many of the others isn't a one continuous table.
Now, this is happening Wednesday night downtown right in front of the Chamber Building,
yes,
right along Independent Drive. So you put this table together and attendees are seated according to their zip codes.
Yes.
How does that work?
So that was very important. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't like you were coming with your friends to sit at another chamber event. So the only way that we could make that happen was to make sure that every single side of town was represented. And so you have to register by your zip code. And each zip code is assigned a color. And on the table is a place setting that's printed on the table in the color of your zip code.
And you have to sit with people from another zip code. Isn't
yes.
that the whole point?
Yes, that is the point.
Yes.
So our communications team, which is amazing, David Johnson, has come up with his own formula to make sure that there are different sequences in the colors on the table. So we provide them with name tags that's in their color, and we have seat guides guide them to their color at the table.
What were the conversations like last year when you put people together from different zip codes that might never have otherwise sat down and eaten a meal together?
You know, I mean, the conversations range. I think the one that touched me, and it still gives me chills to this day, was actually the first year. And Audrey Moran, she was the president of the chamber at that time, the chamber board at that time. She called me over to her table and she said, "Do you mind sharing with her what you just told me?" And there was a woman that had to be 76 years old. She said that she had attended Old Stan and that she had never had dinner with a white woman before.
Mm-hmm.
And that it still affects me to this day because I grew up in a different time, in a different era, and I would have never thought that that was possible. And I wouldn't have believed Audrey if she had told me that on her own, you know, just because you would just think that not in doing this day and age. But to hear that lady say that and to say how this event changed her, it really did something to me. But we've had so many great stories over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
So many great stories.
And there's something about breaking bread together that breaks down barriers and mm-hmm. hostilities and misunderstandings between
yes.
people. If you sit down and eat with someone, that can be powerful.
It is. It's very powerful. We've had a young man who came last year that said he didn't want to go to college, had no idea that he was sitting across from one of the execs at FSCJ who made sure that he enrolled the following semester.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had so many great connections and just so many great things to come out of this. I'm so glad that Daniel took a chance in allowing me to actually to do this.
The CEO of the chamber.
Yes.
If you're tuning in now, we're speaking with Shamika Wright of the Jack's Chamber about the longest table. This is a free shared meal at one long table that happens every year in Jacksonville. It's coming up this Wednesday night downtown along the river. And anyone who wants to come can attend. You can also rub elbows with lots of dignitaries, elected officials, business and faith leaders. And you get the chance to not only meet some great people from across the city, you also get the opportunity to sample culinary delights from
yes.
across the community. I'm just going to read a few of the restaurants that are cooking for Longest Table. The 3G's Grilled and Soul Food Catering, Bellwether, Blue Bamboo, Fuego de Chao, Indochine, Seasons 52, and many more. And how did you pick the restaurants?
Actually, it was just a gamble. I did a restaurant tour here, and I spoke to all of the owners or managers and basically asked if they would be willing to provide a dish in order to feed 600. So you can imagine their faces. And they were like, for free? And I said, yes. You know, this is to bring the community together. So all of the restaurants participate for free. So they provide food for over 600 people for free for us. And so it was just a luck of the draw. Some said yes and some said no.
It's interesting because just the other day I interviewed the author of Foodtown USA. He focused on seven unlikely cities he says are becoming foodie meccas. Jacksonville was one of them.
Yes.
But one of the things he focused on in his chapter on Jacksonville was that white Jacksonville and black Jacksonville don't have a lot of cross-pollination in the culinary world. So if you're white, you probably haven't gone to eat at a soul food style restaurant on the city's northwest side. And if you're black, you might not have gone to some of the, you know, you could call them shishi restaurants in predominantly white neighborhoods. But there are chefs across the city doing amazing things in the culinary world. This is kind of that rare opportunity where you can check it all out at one time,
yes.
It sounds like.
It is. It is. And since we've been doing this is our fourth year, we've had several of the smaller restaurants like 3G's and Mr. Potato Spread who've said that they've received patrons that attended the longest table, that the dish that they had was just amazing and they want to come and support. So that's another thing that has come out of this this event. But you're right. You're absolutely right. So it has opened up not only the culinary world here, but of course it has allowed for different people from different sides of town to participate and at least try the different culinary foods from other areas.
Now, why is the Chamber doing an event like this? You typically think of the Chamber as promoting business, but this is free and all the restaurants are donating. They're not getting paid. So why is this a focus now of the Jack's Chamber?
I think it became a focus. It's always been a focus of our CEO, Daniel, and especially when he brought me on, because yes, the Chamber is known for its economic development, but with economic development, you have people. You have people who are hired in these jobs, people who move to Jacksonville for different experiences. So to show that Jacksonville is opened, to show that Jacksonville is diverse, to show that Jacksonville, a company or an organization that's normally focused on business, is also focused on people. So, you know, I think with him having a different vision, knowing how important it is to bring the community together, it's a good thing.
So with all of that said, you can get a ticket to the longest table. It's free. It's coming up this Wednesday night on Independent Drive downtown in front of the Chamber headquarters. Just go to Eventbrite and search Jack's Longest Table and reserve your spot. So Shamika Wright, she's the Chamber's Community Outreach Director who dreamed this whole thing up. Kudos to you.
Thank you.
Hope for good weather.
Yes, we're praying for good weather.
And have a great time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
WJCT's Oddball podcast is getting national buzz, like this shout out on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast.
What is making me happy this week is a new podcast that I discovered via NPR One. It is a podcast called Oddball.
That's Linda Holmes.
It's fun. It's entertaining.
Or maybe you use Apple Podcasts and saw Oddball featured first on the new and noteworthy list, or you saw it on Stitcher's What's Hot list. Check it out at oddballpodcast.com.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson.
Together, we host the Florida Roundup, a weekly live statewide call-in show looking at the biggest issues impacting the Sunshine State. If it's making news in Florida, you'll hear it on the Florida Roundup. So join us each Friday at noon, right here on 89.9 WJCT.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, tomorrow is Namaste before game day. That's right. It's your chance to practice some yoga on the Jaguars Flex Field next to the stadium. You can also score a ticket to a December home game and support the local nonprofit Yoga for Change. Catherine Thomas is here now. She's founder of Yoga for Change. We're also pleased to welcome Russell Rendon. He's director of group and inside sales for the Jaguars. Hey, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, Catherine, let's start with you.
Okay.
This is a big citywide yoga event at the Flex Field, the practice field that the Jaguars use. You're not going to be throwing a football around. You're going to be doing some yoga. How did this all come about?
Well, we are so honored to be in partnership with the Jaguars, where we are able to be supported for each ticket being sold. And then we're able to actually highlight the four different Lululemon ambassadors here in town. So the class will be pretty diverse, incorporating different styles of yoga. And we're really excited to get people on the field, to get people excited about Jacksonville Jaguar football, and to get some yoga also.
Now, Yoga for Change is focused on bringing yoga to people who are hurting, whether it's people suffering medical issues, people who are incarcerated. You're using yoga as a form of social change and therapy, right?
Yes. So all our students have experienced some sort of trauma, physical trauma, mental trauma, emotional trauma, or sexual trauma. And we give them a new way to deal with that trauma on their mat. So when they step off their mat and go back into our communities, they have a way to sort of give back to the community as opposed to take away from it.
That's such a beautiful model. And Russell, why did the Jaguars decide to get involved in the yoga world? You wouldn't normally think of football and yoga going together. So this is kind of a cool thing.
It is. It's been a lot of fun so far. We do a bunch of different events, whether it's a 5K, a blood drive. We have a STEM day in December, a youth soccer day. And we're just not experts in those fields. So this is where Catherine came in, her group, and it's an extra cherry on top as well, because what she does from a philanthropic side and what she does in her track record. So you won't see me on top there teaching yoga.
That'll be Catherine. Are you going to be in the class?
I'll be running the event.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Good answer.
But it's an awesome partnership. We've joined forces 2 years ago, and we've had a lot of success with it. So it's really fun to have an event on the Flex Field. Not a lot of people get the opportunity to go out there and see what takes place. And we'll have some drills, so there will be some balls being thrown around, some kicking, some field goals, and that type of thing as well. But it is centered around yoga, and we're excited to have a partnership there. And excited that we give $5 back for every participant that goes to it. Plus, it includes a ticket to the game in December of their choice.
And as you mentioned, the Flex Field is such an exciting new addition to the stadium complex, but it isn't something the average person can really always just go into. It's typically reserved for the team to work out. So this is a way for a civilian, I guess, to kind of see what it's like in there.
It is. It's typically not open to the public, and it's an opportunity for us to use the space. And it's actually very conducive for a yoga class. Nice, soft, clean grass field. And then has a nice stage behind it off Daly's place. So it works out really well for us. We're excited about the event and the participation so far.
Now, as someone who has been doing yoga for decades myself, I love yoga. I try to go every week. What would you say to people out there who've never done it? They might be interested, but they might feel a little intimidated.
Well, it's always a chance to start, and especially after yesterday's game, you can stretch and get on this field and have fun. Enjoy the fact that we have the chance now to support a great team in the city and be able to sort of stretch. The excuse, like, I've never tried it, that's really not an excuse. You can try it now, and you get a football ticket out of it, too. So there's a really good way to give back to the city and also nonprofit. You know, we are giving into that Giving Tuesday sort of temperament and feeling, so this is a way to just jumpstart. Start something new, and you can start your New Year's tradition tomorrow.
Especially to the guys out there, I would say, you know, when I first started doing yoga back, I want to say almost in the 80s, you never saw men in yoga classes. Mm-hmm. Now you do.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I go to a weekly class at the Y in Riverside. It's usually almost 50% guys. That never used to happen.
Right. I think, and Russell can correct me wrong, I'm pretty sure most of the Jaguars players do actually practice mm-hmm. yoga as a way to increase their flexibility and also a way to kind of decrease their stress so they can stay present in the plays. Mm-hmm. So we really would recommend anybody who wants to try it just to get out on the field.
Are any of the players going to be on the yoga mat this weekend, or tomorrow, I should say?
Well, it is during the season, so you never know who may be there. But, to Catherine's point, flexibility and coordination are probably the two biggest things for them, and this lends itself really well mm-hmm. To that. So I know there's a majority of the players that do participate in yoga, whether it's the off season or during the season. So it's, again, it's a kind of behind-the-scenes connection that we do have there.
Will this be a beginner class or a little more advanced?
It'll be a class for everybody. So everybody can come. Everybody should show up. Mm-hmm. We have four amazing teachers that are able to talk to the person who's on the mat, whatever level it is. And we're very versed in being able to do that as well. So any physical ability level should plan on coming. If your New Year's resolution is going to be to start something new, why not start it now?
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's talk about the veteran population.
Yes.
Because you work with veterans, Catherine, through Yoga for Change.
Mm-hmm.
You have received a veteran-specific grant
yes.
from the Jaguars Foundation. Tell me about that.
We are so lucky to receive our first grant from the Jaguars Foundation, being able to bring a proven practice, research through Boston University, to help with specifically post-traumatic growth. So veterans, I'm a veteran who's been diagnosed with PTSD. I know that night terrors keep me up at night, and I use my yoga techniques that we teach to our veteran populations, ways to get calm their minds and to calm their bodies so they can actually get a good night's sleep. This is a more community class, so it won't necessarily be diving deeply into our curriculum, but the grant will specifically allow us to teach veterans ways to help with military sexual trauma, post-traumatic growth, traumatic brain injuries, etc.
The Jaguars Foundation, this is just one example, Russell, of the work they do, helping nonprofits like Catherine's. It's really extraordinary how much money this team has given out in this mm-hmm. community to her group, to many other groups, mm-hmm. you know. So kudos to you guys.
Well, I appreciate that. We certainly know how important this community is, and we'd like to be catalyst wherever we can for great events and great organizations like Catherine's.
So with all of that said, how can people be part of tomorrow's big Namaste event at Flex Field?
So it's tomorrow night. It starts at 6:00. To sign up, you'd go to jaguars.com/yoga. Again, jaguars.com/yoga. Has all the information on there that you can sign up and be a part of it. But it does start at 6. The class starts at 6:45 and it will end roughly around 8:15. So we're excited for everyone to show up, and we've got plenty of space out there, and we have a pretty big crowd already attending.
Bring that yoga mat to yes. Flex Field tomorrow night. Going to be amazing.
I hope so. Yep, we're really excited.
Thank you so much, Catherine Thomas. She's the founder of Yoga for Change. Russell Rendon is director of group and inside sales for the Jags. Again, jaguars.com/yoga to come on out tomorrow night for a big mass yoga event on the Jaguars Flex Field. You can also get a ticket to a December home game when you come. Speaking of the Jags, Culpepper's up next with a recap of Nick Foles' lackluster return to the field and some more sports news and notes. We will be right back.
I'm gonna get my share now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they'll fall, one and all.
At Coker Law, when it comes to your health, there's no room for medical mistakes. You rely on your doctors to make informed decisions about your care. Unexpected shouldn't mean unaccountable. Coker Law is dedicated to getting you answers. CokerLaw.com.
Live from the WJCT Soundstage, WJCT and Florida Theater on the Road present Paula Poundstone, humorist, author, and comedian, November 23rd at 8 p.m. as Paula takes the WJCT Soundstage. For tickets and info, visit wjct.org/events.
A handful of copper matte plates made by the British in 1780 and lost until the 1940s finally make their way back to the FHS collections. Coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Dr. James Cusick about these exciting artifacts. We'll discuss the Rockledge Resort District, and we'll learn about early pottery in Florida. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Amazon is under fire for how it handles or doesn't handle counterfeit goods. For the companies being knocked off, it's hard to know what to do.
A lot of sleepless nights started with that phone call saying, how did this happen and what do we do now?
I'm Amy Scott. How fakes are affecting business, next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Access to abortion is changing. So is the way we talk about it. Safe, legal, and rare used to be a catchphrase for those in favor of abortion rights. But now, some supporters say that's too stigmatizing and that we shouldn't be afraid to put abortion front and center. Abortion and its changing rhetoric, that's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap-Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, the Jaguars can probably kiss the playoffs goodbye after this weekend's loss in Indianapolis.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Such a disappointing game for the fans, particularly since there were high hopes for Nick Foles returning to play. Cole Pepper has some thoughts. Hey, Cole.
Good morning. Yeah, it's not a mathematical elimination from the playoffs, but I think it is a practical elimination from the playoffs, a 33-13 loss in Indianapolis. I had so many issues with this game. For one, the Jaguars ran the ball only 9 times the entire game. That's the fewest in franchise history. Hey, by the way, they have Leonard Fournette, who came into the week among the leading rushers in the National Football League, and they didn't use him much. I don't understand that. I think what basically happened was that offensive coordinator John DeFilippo decided he was going to put the game on Nick Foles' shoulders and his return to the lineup. I'm not sure why you'd do that, considering Foles hadn't played a game in 10 weeks. Why not ease him in? Now, granted, he did look pretty sharp in the first couple of drives, but after that, he was forcing passes into double coverage, generally not making good decisions. And DeFilippo didn't make the kind of adjustments you would expect of an offensive coordinator in a game of this importance. The real issue, though, was that they were bullied. The Colts' offensive line pushed the Jaguars' front seven all over the field. It wouldn't have mattered if it was Gardner Minshew or Nick Foles or Joe Montana playing quarterback for the Jaguars. They were not going to win this game. The Colts treated the Jags like they were the younger brother who wanted to try to hang out with the big kids during a Thanksgiving Day pickup game. Jaguars got outmanned. Now, they need to decide that they're going to show up the rest of the year, or we're likely to see some major changes in the front office, in the coaching staff, and the roster after this season.
Wow. Speaking of which, Gardner Minshew was trending on social media during and after the game. Fans were saying, put him back in. What do you say?
You can put him back in. I'm okay with that. It's not going to change the game. As I said, this football is a game built in the trenches, and we all, you know, we are trained to sort of follow the ball as we watch a football game. The quarterback always takes more credit and more blame for a team's success than he should. It didn't matter who the quarterback was. Now, there were some plays, some moments that could have changed how the game played out. There was a strip sack by Yannick Ngakoue, Taven Bryan. All he had to do was fall on the football. The Jaguars would have been in scoring position late in the half and a chance to potentially go up and have a lead at halftime. Instead, he tried to scoop and score, and he didn't come up with it, and the Colts retained possession, and the Jaguars missed an opportunity there. There was a 3rd-and-19 that the Jaguars didn't stop, instead allowing a 31-yard gain on a screen pass by a Colts running back who Jacoby Brissett admitted he didn't really know his name at the time. Jonathan Williams is a kid's name, who had only 2 carries all year long. These are the kind of plays that happen in the course of a game when you are being beaten and ground to dust, which is basically what happened in that game in Indianapolis. It feels like a real low watermark in the season right now for the Jaguars, and I'm not sure how they'll respond. We're going to find out. There have been a lot of fans I've seen on social media really wanting blood right now. They want somebody fired. They want somebody to pay for that. I get it. It doesn't make sense, but I get why fans respond that way. My point is here, let's wait and see how the season plays out before we start firing everybody at the stadium. I think I know where this season is going, but they still have to play the games, And it doesn't do, it's not going to change the course of the season if you start blowing everybody out here in November.
All right. Let's talk about Colin Kaepernick holding workouts in Atlanta for NFL teams. That also got a lot of attention. Can Cap actually land a spot on an NFL team?
Can he? Like physically, can he play in the NFL? Probably. Will he? I don't see it. And I really, like so many things in our world today, I don't think we can take this at face value that it was just a workout to provide an opportunity for Kaepernick to show off to the NFL. I think this was a half-hearted attempt by the NFL to reach into the middle of this long-standing rivalry between Kaepernick and the NFL. But and
let me the guy who started the taking a knee trend among players.
Yes. And so let me take a step back and give some context to this. NFL players who are free agents who want to get a tryout with a team, the team typically invites them to their workout facility, and with no cameras around other than the scouting cameras that the coaches can go back and look at, they put him through their paces, what they want to see. Let's see how his arm strength is. Let's see how his footwork is. Let's see how he responds when we talk with him. Let's give him some situations, have him throw to some receivers, have him throw to some coverage. This was a much different kind of thing. I don't ever remember the NFL setting up a in-season workout for a player. I also think that while it was a little half-hearted from the NFL, I think the Kaepernick camp, I'm not sure if they really wanted to have a real tryout here. I think this was more about keeping Kaepernick front and center for his message. And so
giving them some cover among critics who don't like him not playing.
Maybe there's nothing about this that feels like a regular NFL tryout for a player. The only time we ever see the tryouts is at the combine when the college players are coming out and they air some of those workouts on NFL Network. That's not what this was. I think both sides are kind of playing a part here and trying to play a role to further their own best interest. I don't think this was really about NFL teams truly interested in signing Colin Kaepernick.
Last but not least, Georgia heading to the SEC championship game.
Third straight year, the Dogs beat Auburn on Saturday night, 21-14. They'll play probably LSU. We'll see how it all plays out. Big game for Georgia, though, coming up against Texas A&M on Saturday, because if the Dogs want to make it to the college football playoff, they can't lose another game. But if they win out, I think they'll be in and have a chance to play for a national championship.
Always good to see you. You can catch Cole every Monday talking sports. Follow him on Twitter, @ColePepper. Catch him on TV most nights on Channel 4. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We will be dark tomorrow, but tune in at 9 a.m. as NPR goes back to its live coverage of ongoing impeachment hearings in Washington. Have a great day. We'll see you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.